Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? You're listening to Around the World with Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more on Around the World with Dan Perry.
One week to go, or more precisely, 8 days. 8 days from now, Katie and I will move out of China and fly home to the United States for the summer. And we've been here for about 3 years. And I've been reminiscing a lot about the times that I've had here. The other day I was getting my bicycle fixed and sitting outside of a shop, kind of watching street life go by. I watched a guy picking up cardboard, loading it onto the back of his tricycle, and got back on his tricycle, pedaled past me, and he smiled at me, and I smiled back. There were other kids playing in the street, on the sidewalk, people walking by, people in cars, people on motorcycles, those electric motorcycles that are so popular here, other people on the rented bikes that are all the rage nowadays. Everyone just kind of going about their lives, very busy city, very big city that Beijing is. And I kind of realized everything here just seems so normal now. And I don't even know when this happened, because if I remember right, I think when I first moved here, everything seemed strange. It was my first time in Asia. This felt like a really foreign, really alien place. And now I just seem so comfortable here. I mean, day-to-day life, I've kind of got it figured out. You know, when I first came here, I felt like I was 5 years old. I couldn't read the signs, couldn't talk to anybody, couldn't order a taxi. I didn't know how to do anything. It kind of reminded me of that movie, Mr. Baseball, where, is it Tom Selleck in that movie? Well, the star, he's an American and he plays baseball in Japan. And when he first gets there, they're teaching him all these very basic things. And then he says, guys, come on. You don't have to tell me how to take a crap, or something like that. And then later he goes into the bathroom, opens the stall door, and sees like the squat toilet. And he goes, how do I take a crap? Like, he doesn't know. And I felt like that. Like, I didn't know how to cross the street. I didn't know the most basic things. Like, how do I do this, is what I was constantly thinking. Even little things, like really little things, like water. You can't drink the tap water here, so you drink bottled water. Well, most people get water delivered to their homes, like the Culligan man, but the Chinese version of that. I didn't know how that worked. And so when we first moved into our current apartment, I had to get all that set up. And of course, I called there's like three different companies that do this, and I found one. I actually just flagged down a guy who was delivering water and asked him for a business card. So that's how I started, because I didn't even know like where to look for these water companies. So I got his business card, called the number. They only speak Chinese, so I got a friend to help translate. And I kind of just figured, hey, I'll order a jug of water and they'll deliver it. Well, the thing is, there's like 10 different types of water. They're all different prices. They have different sizes for the water machines. And I didn't know what kind of machine I had. I didn't know if I ordered something, would it even fit? And then how do I keep ordering it so we can keep getting water on a regular basis? And this is just so we can drink water. Well, I got it all worked out. A guy comes and delivers water now regularly. All I have to do is text him and say how much I want, and he comes like an hour or two later, and it's convenient, it's cheap, it's all just kind of done. I don't have to think about it at all anymore. Other things like how to pay the electric bill. How does that work here? Well, it turns out you have to prepay here in China, and that goes for electricity and for the gas for our stove and for our hot water. How do you do that? At first, I had no clue, and so then I figured that out. Like, okay, you got to go to the bank, you got to help get them to help you push some numbers, and it's not too hard now that I have it kind of worked out, but at first I had no idea what was going on. And I could come up with countless examples like this of things that just kind of work right now. And a couple of months ago, we had some friends visiting, and I think it's really good to have friends come over because they can remind me of all the stuff that is kind of not normal if you're not Chinese in China, if that makes sense. For example, we went out to a restaurant, and my friend was looking through the menu, and he said, "Man, these menus here are beautiful. I wish they would do this at home." I was like, "What do you mean they're beautiful? Like it's just a menu." And he's like, "No, every single food item has this professional photograph of that item. And the menu's like 50 pages long." I'm like, "Well, aren't American menus like 50 pages long? Don't they have photographs of every single item? Isn't that how it works at home? I can't remember." He's like, "No, not at all. Like, you might get one photo, like on the front, but otherwise, it's just a listing of words. And you have to visualize what everything looks like." I'm like, "Huh. God, it's been so long since I've been to an American restaurant. I don't even remember what the menus look like. Like, I'm gonna go home, and that's gonna seem weird to me, like seeing a menu without any pictures in it." So there's countless examples of this where things are just kind of working. And like I said before, it's been about 3 years since we moved here. And for both Katie and me, we're super comfortable now. I think if we stayed one more year, well, Katie's kind of got her job figured out, like she's a teacher, and if she stayed at the same school and taught the same grade level, yeah, I don't think she'd have to do nearly as much preparation or figuring out logistics as she had to do her first year. It would be a pretty smooth year. And likewise for me, I think I could cruise by for another year now that we're kind of here. And I think about like what we're giving up by moving out. I mean, when you consider all the stuff that I've had to learn here, let alone the language, I mean, God, when I first moved here, I was studying Chinese, like the spoken language, for maybe an hour a day, and then another hour on the written language. I mean, it's many different countries that you move to, they're going to speak a different language, but the writing system is so much easier in most languages to figure out. Even if they don't use a romanized alphabet, they'll use some sort of alphabet. But Chinese doesn't have an alphabet, it has thousands of characters. And those take a long time to learn. And I'm by no means an expert. I know maybe a few hundred characters. I can get by in day-to-day life, though. That's the important thing. Same with speaking the language. I'm not fluent, but I can get by. I can ask some basic questions. And it's taken me a long time to get here. There was a really steep learning curve. And now I'm starting to think, like, man, is it really worth it just to give all of that up? All of that hard work I've put in just to move out now. And of course, well, we might end up back in China some other day, some other year. It's always possible we'll move back here. But there is a big world out there. There's a lot of places that we haven't been. And Chinese, while it is the most spoken language in the world, if you just go by the number of people who speak it as their first language, it's not that widespread. It's mostly contained within China. And sure, there's a few other countries in Asia where a lot of people speak Chinese, but probably in every example I can think of, more people speak English. And so, yeah, I think it's only going to be super useful to have a working knowledge of the language when I'm in China. So then we come back to that original question. Is it worth it to give it all up? And of course, I don't know yet. We haven't done it yet. I really hope so. I think for me, the way I want to live my life is always be kind of leaning into my edge, always kind of be a little uncomfortable. Not super uncomfortable. I'm not like a masochist. I don't want to torture myself, but I always want to be learning new things. And I think anytime that I start getting really comfortable somewhere, I kind of start getting a little anxious. Like, I want to take up some new hobby or do some new thing. And we're not quite there yet with China. It's, well, we are comfortable, but I'm not quite bored. I think it would take at least another year before I would start going down that path of boredom. So maybe we're leaving a little early. But hopefully a year from now, I will look back on this and think, no, I made the right choice, because we're going to go travel the world for a year and we'll always be leaning into our edge. I've done one long trip around South America, and which I documented in my book, 1,000 Days Between, Part 1. And I'm almost done with Part 2. It's going to be out maybe in a month, maybe 6 weeks. Sometime this summer, look for that in bookstores and online. But during that trip, I realized travel, long-term travel, not just going on a holiday for a week and relaxing at a resort, long-term backpacking-style travel is a lot of work. It's like a full-time job, and then some, because while here in China, here in Beijing, I should say, I just had to learn all of the stuff that I explained just once. When you're traveling, you've got to learn all that stuff over and over. Every time you go to a new city, how do the buses work? I don't know. And then once you move to a new country, all of the language skills that you picked up in the previous country just go away. Obviously, I speak English. That's by far the most useful language in the world. If there's one language you want to speak as a world traveler, in general, of course, there's exceptions, but in general, it's English. But travel just requires constant learning, which is kind of what I love about it. So we'll see how it goes. I plan to continue making this podcast while we're on the road, and I hope you'll listen in. This might even become my main form of communication with the outside world. Blogging, I'm doing less and less of it as time goes on, but I'm really into this podcasting thing. So I've got a lot of great ideas. I hope you will join me for what should continue to be a weekly show going well into the future. All right, let's get to the main part of this episode. My guest today is Debbie Ma. She is from Taiwan originally, although she has lived basically in the United States and China for most of her life, from what I can tell. She's also traveled a lot in Japan. So we talked about all three of those places. And she's also got some interesting hobbies. She's a home brewer, so she knows a lot about the microbrewery scene here in Beijing, and that's quickly spreading around China, so you'll get to learn a little bit more about that. And, well, her other thing is not her hobby, it's her profession, is she's an acupuncturist. So she taught me a little bit about what acupuncture is and just the very basics of Chinese medicine and how that all works. She was a really fun guest, and I had a great time talking to her. So let's listen to my conversation with Debbie Ma.
There's so many big breweries in Beijing, and the Chinese, there's like two main ones that run by Chinese. One is Enbeer, Niu Pi Tang, and the other is Panda Brew. That's down in Beijingqiao.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Panda Brew. I don't know Enbeer.
Oh, really?
No, yeah.
Because their first brew pub is in Huguosi, and the other is in. They used to have a brew pub in a tap room in Sanlitun, Soho, and then there's one in now in Wukesong. That one is huge. They have like thousands of bottles, like empty bottles from all around the world.
From different breweries?
Yeah, well, I mean, they have the collection of bottles, like, because the founder is called Xiao Bier, and he's been collecting bottles since, for maybe 10 years or more, And it used to be all in his place. And then maybe his wife and him got a fight or something. And so they opened up a place just to put his collections.
They had to rent a new place for that?
Yeah. I haven't been there, but it looks amazing because up on the wall, it's all his collections.
Whoa.
So they call it the Beer Museum.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's from, like, I don't know how many countries, more than 60.
Huh, maybe you can show me where this is on a map and I can go
check it out before I leave. It's in Wukesong on line 1.
Oh, right, okay. I went to that neighborhood once on my first weekend in Beijing because there's a big camera market there.
Oh, no idea.
Like high-end camera equipment. That's the only time I've been there.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe
I think
I'll be able to check it out.
They open up a new shopping place or something. So that's a new trendy place.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That sounds cool. And is that the N beer?
Yeah, Niu Pi Tang.
Okay.
And beer.
Hmm. And now you brought over this ginger beer that you just made. So I take it you're into brewing beer too?
Yes. Yeah. This has been my hobby for 2.5 years. And in the beginning, I've moved back to Beijing on 2014. And I just want to find where I can find clients for my patient, like being my patients. Like, and I joined this meetup group. It's a Beijing Homebrewing Society. And then I discovered a new world. Like, people in the brewing society are super nice and it's just fun.
Sounds cool. Are they mostly foreigners or Chinese too?
At the beginning, the meeting was all foreigners, and they have the Chinese meetings in a separate day. And now we all have the meetings together every second Tuesday of the month. So yesterday was our meeting of June.
Wow, so you're bringing cultures together through beer.
Yeah, and within these 3 years I've been in Beijing, just seeing the whole craft beer scene is getting bigger and bigger throughout the whole China, not only Beijing.
Right. Now, do people bring their own beer that they just brewed
yes.
to these meetings? And
yes.
you all share beer?
Yes.
Oh, that
yes.
sounds cool.
Yes. And then so, like yesterday, there were maybe more than 30 people were there. And we just share beer and talk about like how the brewing process, like what's the special of this beer I brew and what special ingredients I add or something like that. And then after that, everybody starts sharing their beers together.
Oh, that's awesome. I've been to a few of the breweries here in Beijing, but I don't go to them too often. Craft beer has been a big thing for like in my home state in Wisconsin for a little bit longer, maybe 10 years.
Yeah.
But it's really big there too.
Yeah, there's so much breweries in the States, and like every few days there are a new brewery, and so.
But I'm noticing them here in Beijing too. Like I just walk down the road, and every couple months I'll see a new one that wasn't there before.
Yes.
So they're popping up all over the place.
Yes, it's being crazy now. Like it used to be, only. Panda, N Beer, Jing A, Slow Boat, and Great Leap. What else did I miss? Arrows.
Yep.
And now there's more and more like little breweries, microbreweries, and brew pubs and tap rooms. And our brewing group start from the Chinese group start from like when I joined there was only 200 something, and now there's 3 big groups right now. So each group is 500 people in it.
Whoa.
Yeah, and that's just the Beijing group.
Wow, those are all home brewers?
Some are home brewers, some are like owner of a pub, or some are suppliers for malts or stuff, beer related things.
Huh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess drinking is pretty popular here in China, and the kind of bigger beers here, the Qingdao and
Their market has been sliding a bit because of this beer.
Has it?
Yes.
Huh, okay. So it's very similar to what's happening in the States.
States. Yes.
Yeah, just maybe a few years behind, a few years later.
We're in China, it's just booming. It's really getting bigger and bigger, and people are getting seriously focusing on how to make great beer. But still, they're trying to define what craft beer is. Like, craft beer, what craft beer really means to Chinese. Because in the States, it's a kind of a different culture. And
yeah, how so?
It's so hard to explain. It's like a beer revolution. They want to brew their own beer, and not just like Budweiser or Coors beer, those kind of things. And so bring your own beer, it has the, by using different ingredients or stuff, you have your love and soul in the beer. And in China, some people went into this industry because they really love beer, but there are also some that just want money. So there's still, some people are still, it depends on what they look into this business.
So some of it still is on the maybe more corporate side.
Yes.
Like exploiting like a niche market.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I get the feeling, at least for American brewers, that they just really have a passion for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that it makes good money too.
Yes.
But the passion is the bigger thing, usually.
Well, there are a big bunch of people in Beijing. They there are so many WeChat accounts that talk about like craft beer, and you can see like a lot of Chinese are trying to understand, like trying to create that kind of scene in Beijing, in China as well. So we have all these competitions, and there's all different beer societies setting up in different cities throughout China. And every year, like from May to to October, we have this beer master cup, and it's a beer competition. So people from all around China will send beer to one city for the competition, and at the end, after five competitions, we'll have a final competition, and then we'll get like who's the really master cup of that year.
Huh. And what city is that in?
This year, there's the next one will be in Xiamen. So we.
And remind me, where is that?
Down in Fujian.
Oh, okay, maybe southeastern.
South, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's not so far from Taiwan.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And now, because of this, there's some Taiwanese judges, beer judges, are coming over to judge the beer. And in the beginning, by judging beer, they most of them are just homebrewers or really enthusiastic in beer. Yeah. But now it's more and more serious, so now we have the BJCP judges. And these beer judges are more professional, so they can really go by the textbook to judge the beers and see what's the best beer in China, like that.
Hey, sounds cool. Can anyone go to this from the public?
You can join the competition. You don't need to be a member or anything.
Can you just go and drink beer and have fun?
For judging beer, no, but for if there's a beer festival, sure.
I mean, I don't mean judging, I just mean go and drink and try all these different beers.
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
It's only for the judges.
Okay, because in Madison, where I'm from, there is this, I think they call it Great Taste of the Midwest, once a year, and they bring in all these brewers from all around the country.
Oh, cool.
In this big park. And you pay one entrance fee. I think it's like $50.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just drink anything, whatever you want. And they'll make, like, brewmasters will make small batches of mm-hmm. weird beers and, like, just really creative things just for that competition.
Wow.
And they only sell a small amount of tickets.
Uh-huh.
So there's no long lines or anything.
Oh, that's nice.
And, yeah, and it's, so it's this really big, like, really popular festival. It's actually kind of hard to get tickets for it.
Hmm. So I should suggest our president, like, we should do something like this.
Yeah, I can send you the website
for it,
so you can learn more about it.
Uh-huh.
But that would be great.
Although our society is getting lots of recognitions, but still, for most Chinese, they don't know that you can really brew at your home.
Yeah.
It's not so hard, but yeah.
Well, how hard is it to get the ingredients?
Now it's not so hard. There are so many websites on Taobao, or there are suppliers in Beijing, so you can just buy them from these suppliers. And then, yeah, it's not so hard. And with the equipment, you just need pots and pans.
Huh. Wow, that's cool. And that, I guess I had no idea it was this popular now. And it's spreading all around China.
Remember Katie used to brew as well?
She did, like, before we met. I guess she did a few batches of home brew, so she was kind of into it. And she knows a lot more about it than me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
It started becoming popular, I think, maybe 10 years ago in the States.
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s, there were only a handful of breweries in the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
Because it used to be like 100 years ago, every little town had their own brewery. Because it was just difficult to ship it long distances.
Yeah.
But then shipping improved and big companies bought up all the small ones. And it turned into like 4 or 5 breweries that control just about everything.
Yeah, recently, like, AB and Bev have been buying all these bigger, they bought Boxing Cat so far ago. And
they're buying, like, little Chinese breweries, too?
All around the world.
Oh, wow. And that's Miller, or? Which beer do they make?
Miller.
Or yeah. Bud, or?
I think Budweiser.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, anyways, Heineken bought Goose Island. Not Goose Island. AB and Bev bought Goose Island, and Heineken bought Lagunitas. So, yeah. So this is another thing that in the beer world we're afraid of, because they might, with a big corporation getting involved with craft beer, and they might want to control it or something like that, and then...
Right, yeah. Could happen that way. I think as long as you know who owns the brewery, you know, like we have maybe 4 or 5 in Madison that are completely independent,
mm-hmm.
and everybody just knows that. And if a big brewery bought them, I'm not saying that no one would go anymore, but a lot of people would stop.
It really depends on if the original brewer can still control what he likes to brew and how the ingredients and all that, then it should be still fine. Like, well, for now, Goose Island still owns, like, the controlling of the company. But some people will be like, nah, I'm not going to taste their beer or anything.
Right. Yeah, there's just something about it that... It seems to get watered down, if you pardon the pun, when a big company buys a small one, just the love goes out of it.
Yeah.
All the creativity is gone, and it's just about making money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the product suffers, and people notice.
I know, you know, right.
So hopefully that doesn't happen here.
Hopefully. So, right. People are still, like, at least for now, everything is... People are still trying hard to get their own brands bigger and bigger and more recognized in China and outside as well. Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned you're from Taiwan.
Yes.
Where in Taiwan are you from?
Hsinchu. In between Taipei and Taichung. It's like an hour from Taipei.
Oh.
It's like south from Taipei.
Okay. I know very little about Taiwan, but Katie and I are going there in maybe November. We'll be in Taiwan. We want to bike around it.
Uh-huh.
Would you suggest going to your area?
Well, my area depends on what you like. My city is more like a university, and it used to be Taiwan's Silicon Valley. We have a science park there, so like all the chips are made from our city, from Taiwan. And there's two main universities, Tsinghua University, the same as the one in Beijing.
Right.
And Jiao Tong University. Mm. Yeah. But as for food or scenic wise, it's okay.
Just okay?
Yeah.
Well, I heard the east side has not as many people.
Yes.
And more scenery.
Yes, because most Taiwanese live on the west coast, and the east coast is more mountains. So.
Oh, well, that's what we're looking for.
Yeah, I know. Or yeah. You can go to the middle part. There's all mountains. But
right.
The best views could be more on the south and the east.
Okay. So
actually, everywhere is pretty, but
oh,
yeah.
I hear it. It's like everybody loves Taiwan. I hear so many good things about it.
Thanks.
And it's not too big, you know?
Like for biking, probably it takes you, it depends on how fast or slow you want, but usually like 2-3 weeks should be enough.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, that's probably about what we'll spend. We want to go to Japan first.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe cool. In September, spend all of October in Japan. And then.
Which part?
Well, the South Island, but from what I'm gathering from people I've talked to, it sounds like the north has fewer people, and then there's a couple of other like really nice scenic spots on the west side, opposite Tokyo. Do you know Japan at all?
Yes. I think I know Japan more than I know Taiwan.
Oh, really?
Well, but for like mountain, like hiking or that, maybe I don't know that much. Mostly I stay in Tokyo and Kyoto, Osaka. But this 2 months ago in April, I went to Kyushu. It's like down in the south.
Kyushu.
Okay. So Tokyo is here, and so it's more on the southwest of Japan.
And what's in Kyushu?
There's so many, it's beautiful there. There's so many, there are volcanoes, and there's a lot of hot springs. So we get to pretty much do, like, we stayed in two hot spring hotels, one in the north and one down in the south. And the one is like, it's almost the southest part of Kyushu. And they have the hot spring is from the sea or something, so you can just lie on the beach, and they'll cover you up with sand.
Oh, this sounds good.
And underneath is just hot. You can feel the warmth coming. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I heard about a place in New Zealand where you can do this.
Uh-huh.
Like you dig your own hole and get in. And,
yeah.
And there's a hot spring under it. So this sounds similar.
Uh-huh.
Ooh, sounds good to
me. Like the hotel we stayed in, they have you can go by the sand and then you just walk in the waters. And there's like half of it is cold. The sea is cold. But when you walk close to the other side, you can feel the hot spring going through. So when you bury your feet in the sand, you can feel like it's getting hotter and hotter. Hmm. Yeah, so that's pretty cool. And the whole place is beautiful and pretty relaxing. And we biked a little bit in a small island called, I don't know in English. So it's close to Kuroshima, or
close to Hiroshima?
No.
Kurushima? Or
I always read it in Chinese, so it's Lu Er Dao in Chinese.
Okay.
So there's a volcano and it's still alive, and you can bike around the whole island.
Oh, and you can get a boat to take you there?
Yes, there's a ferry from the port from Hiroshima or no. Anyways, you can get the ferry and then go to the island and you can bike around there.
Okay, sounds cool. Did you, so you lived in Japan for a while?
No, I just love traveling there, so.
Oh, okay. Do you speak the language at all?
Not really.
No?
No. And I only know a little bit, but I can go by with that. And just use a little bit, Japanese and English should be fine. Yeah.
A fair amount of people speak English there?
I think it's okay.
Oh, it is? Okay. Yeah. I've heard it's not many.
Well, if you're in big cities, it should be fine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, our thought on that is we might end up going to Tokyo just for a couple days someday in the future, mm-hmm. like have a conference there or something and just go for a weekend. And so it's pretty easy to get there. So we'd rather spend most of our time in nature and small towns and mm-hmm. areas where it takes a little longer and it's harder to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And nicer on a bike, too.
Yeah, really, it's really nice on bikes because their sceneries are... It's just, you can just go slowly and see everywhere.
Yeah.
We rented bikes there, like, for 2 days and just biked around, and it feels really good.
Oh, sounds awesome. Yeah, I mean, so we live in Beijing, of course, and there are many, many great things about Beijing. I mean, we've really enjoyed being here, mm-hmm. but at the same time, there's a lot of people all the time. And it, you know, there's the air pollution is always an issue. And it's just, we just want to be outside a lot and just enjoy nature.
Yeah, I know you guys hike a lot, right?
Yeah, we do. There's a lot of good hiking here in near Beijing,
mm-hmm.
like especially around the Great Wall.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, sometimes even once you go out to the Great Wall, the air pollution can be bad.
Yeah, right.
And it's one of the saddest things when you have to wear a mask just to walk outside in nature. You're not even in the city anymore.
It's really sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. We went to, the last time we were in Kyushu, the weather was really good and the air is amazing. Because of the hot springs and all that, the water is super clean. So there is, I don't know, we saw some place in on Airbnb, and there's this place you can live in the mountains, and the house is like more than 100 years old. And they even have a canoe that you can use just nearby their house. There's a river. Hmm. So... yeah, maybe I can send you that link if would like to try to go there.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And that's on that island? Or is that
on the upper opposite side of that island. But like if this big as Kyushu, it will be on that side.
So like southwest?
Southwest.
Or southeast?
Southeast.
I'm looking at you, so everything's reversed.
Southeast, yes.
That's great. So you've... let's see, you're from Taiwan, but you've traveled a lot in Japan. You live in China, though.
Yes.
How long have you lived in China?
On and off, this is the 11th year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And always in Beijing or other parts?
Always in Beijing.
Hmm.
Yeah, I've tried to, I've been to other cities, but some people say, why don't you work in Shanghai? It's easier to live there, but... I think I like the culture in Beijing.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like there's always the Shanghai people and the Beijing people. And Katie and I really like Beijing over Shanghai.
Yeah.
It's because it's more...
There's more historical things in here. And
more history, more monuments, more culture.
Mm-hmm.
And Shanghai just seems to be all...
just a big city.
Yeah, big city, lots of shopping, brand new stuff.
Right.
It's easier though in Shanghai. I mean, a lot of people speak English there, so that makes it easier for us.
Yeah, and there's a lot of Taiwanese there. But I don't know, it just doesn't feel like I have lots of chances to go. I have a license back in California, and my friends back there always want me to stay there. But it's just like a calling me back to Beijing. So, like, I've moved back and forth, and this is my third time living in Beijing.
So what's your license for?
Acupuncture, Chinese medicine.
Okay. And that's what you're doing here, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and I have to admit, I know almost nothing about any of this stuff, so it'd be interesting to hear about it. Can you explain a little bit what acupuncture is?
Acupuncture, well, most people think it's just needles sticking in people.
That's as much as I know. That's the limit of my knowledge.
But actually, acupuncture is, well, if you trace it way back to... with Chinese medicine, it's all about like balancing the body, the energy inside the body. So there's 14 main meridians, and the meridians are like the channels where the qi flows inside our body. And these meridians connect to different organs of our body, like our lung, our heart, our liver, kidney, and all that. So if any of these organ energy is not functioning right, like either it's too weak or it's the qi is stuck, then we can use either acupuncture or Chinese herbs to help to get rid of the stagnation or boost your energy. Or if there's like blood stagnation, we can remove that stagnation. So something like that. So there's 361 points in acupoints, and we just choose like which points, the function of the points, and then choose which points are helpful for your condition. So that's basically what acupuncture does.
And you combine that with actual herbs or Chinese medicine?
Well, you can just use acupuncture, or you can combine them together. Depends on what's the problem is.
Okay, and this is for a variety of medical issues or pain?
Yes.
Or
not only pain. There's like for digestion conditions or allergies, cold or even neuropathy, any type of neural conditions, or even like if you have stress or kids that have ADHD, it's all treatable with acupuncture. Like even I used to work on cruise ships, and I met lots of people that have problems that Western medicine can't help with, like Huntington's disease or Parkinson's. And they've been using Western medicine for almost all their lives. And after acupuncture, they feel much better than just using Western medicine. Hmm. Yeah.
Wow, okay. So if somebody has some problem that they want to give attention, they just make an appointment with you, and you just ask them questions and do a diagnosis?
Yes. So, well, how we diagnose is one is just like in Western medicine, you ask what's your main conditions and all that. But we also have this tongue and pulse analysis. So we check your pulse and then check your tongue, and it'll give us some more information, like which organ energy is low, or there's fire inside, or there's... it just shows me or there's dampness, and that will tell me like what condition it is, and I'll know how to like prescribe a formula for you or use what acupoints to treat you. Yeah.
And so, do you have a combination then of Chinese and foreign clients, or is it mostly foreign?
For now, mine is mostly foreign, maybe 90%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't meet many Chinese people with English as good as yours, so that that must help a lot.
Yeah, but well, it's yeah. That's why I'm back here, because I've worked on the ship for 2 years, and mostly my patients are all foreigners and Chinese. Well, because I'm in Beijing and there's so many famous doctors in Beijing, so I can't compete with them. And
oh, okay. And that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, so this is, I just want to be like a bridge for foreigners to understand Chinese medicine. Yeah, that's why I'm back in Beijing.
Well, you've already given me a good explanation.
Thanks.
All right. So you think you'll make this kind of your permanent home then?
I don't know. I'm still thinking. Every 6 months, I'll be like, because of the weather or the air, I'll be thinking maybe I shouldn't be living here. But then it's like, I still like Beijing. And yeah, I just keep staying.
Well, I spent a couple months in Yunnan earlier this year. It was beautiful. Just blue skies every day.
I know.
Just really, really fantastic place. The scenery was great. There's like these awesome rolling hills, and yeah, really beautiful part of China.
I've only been to Lijiang once.
Yeah.
But for a very short period of time, and that was in with the Shiyi holidays, the August, October holidays. So there's so many people.
Oh, yeah.
And
that town is so, it's overrun with people now.
I know.
It's one of these towns that they've got their own like ancient part of the town, and you have to pay money to get into it. And
yeah,
it does. I mean, I thought it did look pretty cool, but Katie and I were there at a very not busy part of the year.
Uh-huh. It should be even better, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It wasn't too bad for us, but still it's still very touristy. So I spent a lot of time in Shaanxi.
Shaanxi.
It's between Lijiang and Dali.
Uh-huh.
Like halfway. That's just this little village, and I think it's starting to become more popular now with tourists, but not quite there yet.
What's special there?
It's this ancient little village with an old square, and it's got a Buddhist temple, and mm-hmm. it's got like this ancient theater. It's just really calm, really quiet. It's on this river in a valley, and there's a couple other little villages nearby, and a lot of a lot of crops grow near there, and there's mountains mm-hmm. surrounding it, and it's a really scenic place and peaceful and quiet. And nice. And I stayed in a hostel for a month, and the people there were just fantastic. So we had dinner every night together with all the employees,
uh-huh.
and they made Yunnan food, every like home cooked Yunnan food.
Cool.
Yeah, just really good vibe there.
Then you might. Yeah, when you're traveling in Taiwan, you might like the East Coast. Like, we have lots of different tribes in the mountains and in the East Coast. So it might have, like, that kind of vibe. So it'll be, you can try our, like, those traditional, how do you call it? We have 9 different tribes in Taiwan.
Okay.
And they're the original people that lived in Taiwan. And they trace back that people from New Zealand, the Maoris, are they?
Yeah,
they were from Taiwan as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
So, and they have their own tradition, their language, their costumes and all that. So they have different, they use local ingredients to make different dishes, and yeah, it could be a little bit like what you feel in Yunnan.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's the other thing about that area in Yunnan, is there's a lot of these small ethnic groups,
mm-hmm.
the smaller tribes that are just, yeah, really interesting, diverse culture, too. Right. So are you Han?
I think so, yeah. Well, like, My ancestor moved from Fujian to Taiwan like 300 years ago.
Huh, okay.
Yeah.
And are most people in Taiwan Han now?
Like mixed.
Oh, okay.
We're all mixed because there were like I said, there were 9 different tribes,
yeah.
And there's Han people coming, and before that, and after that, there were Spanish or Portuguese or Japanese been colonized for quite different, with different countries and nations for quite a period of time. And then until the Chinese government, the KMT, came to Taiwan. That was 1949. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Oh, so it's a bit of a mixture today.
Yes. So we just say we're Taiwanese. There's no, we don't really say we're Han or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't talk about it like that in Taiwan.
Some will say if you're, we mostly will say you're Taiwanese or you're, we say 外省人, like your grandparents or something, they came after 1949.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's another bigger group is Hakka.
Oh, okay. I've heard of them in China, mainland China.
There are Hakka from China, and there are Hakka in Taiwan as well. So if, like, in Hsinchu, the Hsinchu, Miaoli, and Taoyuan, these areas have a lot of Hakka people. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And the food is different. The culture is different.
Yeah. And you also lived in LA, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that where you learned English, or
no?
In
actually,
Taiwan?
I was born in the States.
Oh.
And
okay.
When I was 6, we moved back to Taiwan.
Ah,
yeah.
I see.
So I have the accents, but not enough vocabulary.
Well, it sounds great to me.
Thanks. Yeah, I was in LA for a year for my master's degrees and my license. Yeah.
Oh, you got your acupuncture license in LA?
Yeah, I have both licenses in China and in the States.
Ah, okay, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize they're separate.
With medical license, they're all separate in any country. So I can't, even in the States for acupuncture license, mine is California license, and there is another, like, a national license. So I can't go to New York if I want to, and I need to take another license exam.
Huh. And so how much schooling do you have to go to then to do this? It's too much, huh?
Too much. Yeah, in China it's 5 years for med school, and if only in the States, it takes only 3 years. But I don't think 3 years is enough. And so I did 5 years here and then 1 year back in the States and came back for another 3 years for PhD.
I guess any sort of doctor or medical profession at all, it's just crazy amount of studying.
Well, when I look back, I'll be like, I should start working earlier than just studying, because on, like, clinical wise, I learn more during when I'm practicing.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So, like, when you're studying, you don't practice on people?
Not much. You don't
mostly
have
just books?
Yeah, you don't have time.
Ah, okay. Hmm. Yeah, that's kind of how it was for me with computer science. I mean, I learned a lot, but it's all theory.
Yeah.
School, and then once I got out in the real world, I started to learn how things actually work. And I guess I got to use some of the knowledge that I learned in college, but really, it's almost like starting over.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess getting a college degree just kind of shows employers that you're willing to learn, willing to put in the time and effort to do something.
Yeah.
All right, well, we can wrap this up then.
Sure.
It's been great meeting you. Thanks for coming over.
No problem, thanks.
Thanks to Debbie Ma for coming on the show, and thank you for listening. As usual, if you want more information about the stuff we talked about today, more pictures and links to interesting articles that I found around the interwebs, you can head to my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number, 1000daysbetween.com. And I'll catch you next week.